This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new exhibit at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum explores the souvenirs and mementos veterans bring back from war to help them remember their service. We'll talk to the curator of that new exhibit. Now it's time for the latest installment of the WPR Report's podcast, Mapped Out. Last week, we heard about the biggest legal challenge to Wisconsin's current political district maps. That case made it to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2017. Justices remanded it back to lower courts without ruling on whether our state's maps were unconstitutional. Today, Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson explore how those district lines have impacted policy here in Wisconsin in the 10 years since they were drawn. They've allowed Republicans in the legislature to lock in changes to things like union rights and business tax credits, even limiting the powers of the governor's office. Those changes are likely to stick around even after a new governor changed the political dynamic in the state capital.
On the night of November 6, 2018, the crowd at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Madison is going berserk.
It's election night, or technically the morning after election night at this point. After a long night and a close race, the Associated Press has called Wisconsin's race for governor. Republican incumbent Scott Walker has been defeated by Democratic challenger Tony Evers.
Evers, the mild-mannered state school superintendent and former teacher, is yelling into the microphone.
I feel confident in saying to you right now, my name is Tony Evers, and I'm going to be the next governor of the state of Wisconsin.
This is a statewide election, so those legislative district lines we've been talking about, they don't matter here. Evers defeats Walker by a little more than a percentage point.
For Democrats, this moment has felt like a long time coming. Scott Walker had been governor for 8 eventful years, and for that entire time, Republicans had gotten their way.
Democrats think Evers' win will put a stop to that, that the pendulum of power has swung back in their direction.
And as I said throughout this campaign, it's time for a change. The voters of Wisconsin spoke, and they agree a change is coming, Wisconsin. God bless you. Thank you all.
But that didn't last long. The day after the election, Robin Voss, the powerful Republican Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, floats an idea. Republicans, he says, might look at ways to limit the governor's powers.
And lawmakers move fast. A couple weeks later, they introduce a package of bills that would take powers away from the governor and new Democratic Attorney General right before they take office.
The day the bills are formally introduced for a public hearing, Voss downplays them. He says they're not about any one person. They're about the balance of power in state government.
If you read the Constitution, the first branch that is mentioned is the legislative, because that is supposed to be the most representative of the people. We are the ones that are the closest. We are the ones that are the closest. We are the ones that have the most direct impact on people's lives.
But Voss didn't introduce these bills in the nearly 8 years that Scott Walker has been governor.
Voss's counterpart in the state Senate, Republican Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, is more blunt.
Well, listen. I'm concerned. I think that Governor-elect Evers is going to bring a liberal agenda to Wisconsin.
Both houses pass the bills, and Scott Walker signs them just weeks before he will leave office.
Walker doesn't have to worry about any repercussions of this lame duck session. He's on his way out.
And GOP lawmakers don't have to worry either, but for a different reason. Despite Democratic victories up and down the ballot in the 2018 election, Republicans still won big majorities in both houses of the legislature.
In Wisconsin, the political pendulum still swings, but only so far. And when one party has power locked down, there's a lot it can do.
From WPR Reports, I'm Bridget Bowden.
And I'm Sean Johnson. This is Mapped Out.
Before we go any further, we need to make an important point. A lot of the stuff people might remember from the Walker years did not happen because of the political district maps that Republicans passed in 2011. For some of that stuff, those maps didn't exist yet. Like Act 10, Scott Walker's historic changes to public sector unions.
I say workers, you say right! Workers,
right!
Workers,
right!
I say workers, you say right.
That is passed by the 2011 legislature, which was elected on a map drawn by a court in 2002.
And Wisconsin's voter ID law?
I think the vast majority of our citizens want to make sure that their vote is a legal vote and that all the votes out there are legal votes.
The Republicans got the majority in the state Senate, and they are going directly after the Democrat Party. That's all this is.
It is also passed in 2011 by a legislature elected under the old map. But the new map, the one Republicans drew in 2011 that largely survived scrutiny by the courts, is still extremely relevant. Because once it takes hold, everything that passes in 2011 is effectively locked in.
And it's not just the stuff that thousands of people showed up to protest. Other major decisions by that legislature in that year are locked in, too. Here's an example.
One night during budget deliberations that year, Republicans on the budget committee make a couple decisions. Money is tight, so they cut state funding from the University of Wisconsin system.
It is only a $250 million cut. We did not. But the cut is what it is. And
so Republicans say they don't want to cut the UW, they just have to.
But that same night, they also passed something that would cost the state money, a new tax credit for manufacturers and agricultural businesses. Republican Robin Voss is chairing the committee that night.
And here we are saying, if you're a manufacturer, come to Wisconsin. Make things here.
And Democrats like Tamara Grigsby have had it.
This is shameful. And I'm sorry, I know we're all tired of that word, but there is no other word. This is outrageous. Wow.
Democrats are frustrated, because they say this tax credit will be too expensive for the state over the long haul. Voss tells them you have to take it one budget at a time.
But in the future, when Democrats try to repeal this tax credit and boost university funding, they're never taken seriously. So the cost of the tax credit grows.
And today, according to the legislature's nonpartisan budget office, it will have cost the state roughly $2 billion since it was passed, while state funding for the university over the past decade has been roughly flat.
When one party controls every budget for 10 years, decisions like these get locked in.
So what's it like in the legislature after the new map kicks in 2012? Let's just say Republicans stay busy. When you don't have to worry about losing your majority, you can do a lot. And we don't have time to list everything, but here's some of the big stuff.
They start the 2013 session with a bill that would rewrite Wisconsin's mining laws. It would clear the way for a massive iron mine in northern Wisconsin that could be 1,000 feet deep, 3/4 of a mile wide, and eventually 22 miles long.
If there's any state that can move forward with a way to streamline the process for safe and environmentally sound mining, shouldn't it be the Badger State?
This is just a couple years after the big Capitol protests, less than a year after Scott Walker's recall win. Tensions are still high in Wisconsin, and this issue accentuates it.
The only way to fix this bill is to throw it into a trash can.
But in this legislature, the outcome is never really in doubt. It passes with only one Republican voting against it.
This is around the time when Walker introduces his budget. And like any budget, it's full of ideas. One of those ideas, expanding Milwaukee's taxpayer-funded private voucher school program to other parts of the state.
This is why we provide new choices for parents in areas where schools are failing to meet expectations.
This isn't the first voucher school expansion Republicans pass, and it won't be the last. Wisconsin's private school voucher program is now statewide.
Over time, Republicans are emboldened. After they passed the public sector union restrictions in 2011, there's speculation that they might go after private sector unions, too, with a so-called right-to-work law. And for a while, they downplay this. But after the 2014 election, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says he's thinking about it.
I mean, there's some of us that feel like since Act 10, there's some unfinished business when it comes to the unions in Wisconsin.
And remember those massive crowds that showed up in 2011? Some think that might happen again, but this time, Fitzgerald isn't worried about it.
With some of the veterans that quite honestly don't care anymore, that if the crowds show up and that if the Capitol blows up again, we just don't care. We've been through the recalls, we've been through it all. If we're going to do it, let's do it.
And they do. Wisconsin, a state with deep union roots, passes right to work.
Session after session, Republicans pass new restrictions on abortion. They also restrict funding.
We defunded Planned Parenthood and passed pro-life legislation.
By 2015, Republicans ban abortions after 20 weeks. They also require ultrasounds for people seeking abortions.
And Republicans aren't just passing new laws during these years. In some cases, they're undoing bipartisan deals they once supported.
Like the deal they cut with Democrats in late 2006 to create a new nonpartisan ethics and elections agency. Democrat Jim Doyle was governor at the time.
Under this agreement, we will create a single, strong, independent, and completely nonpartisan government accountability board.
Republican lawmakers like Scott Fitzgerald and Robin Voss vote for that deal. But almost a decade later, their circumstances have changed. After the Government Accountability Board investigates Scott Walker and his conservative allies, in 2015, GOP lawmakers disband the agency.
Today, we are beginning the process of ending the failed experiment known as the Government Accountability Board.
So you see, Republicans are able to accomplish a lot in the years that followed the 2011 map. There's a lot you can do when your power is locked in.
And sometimes, if you don't want to, you can choose to do nothing. That's after the break.
We're listening to the latest episode of the podcast Mapped Out from WPR Reports. This week, Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden are looking at how Wisconsin's electoral maps led to policy changes during the last decade. As we're hearing, they allowed a lot of changes to get locked in for the future, even when a new governor takes office. We'll hear more coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening to the newest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. This week, how Wisconsin's electoral maps helped change the direction of policy in the state since they were put in place a decade ago.
Do you remember where you were on March 11th, 2020? If that date doesn't ring a bell, it's the day that the NBA postponed its season and Tom Hanks announced he had COVID-19. For a lot of people, it was when the pandemic first seemed real. Like for Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald.
On March 11th, seemingly overnight, daily life for Wisconsinites and the nation changed dramatically.
For a brief time, there's bipartisan cooperation in state government. Fitzgerald and Republicans are working with Democratic Governor Tony Evers on a big coronavirus bill.
Wisconsinites have endured great sacrifice, and the measures that we have taken and that the governor has taken so far are working.
At the time, this is, to put it mildly, unusual, because Republicans have been fighting with Evers since before he even took office.
This cooperation doesn't last. The day after lawmakers pass this COVID-19 bill and send it to Evers, the governor's office extends Wisconsin's stay-at-home order. And less than a week later, Republicans sue to block it.
They win. The stay-at-home order is gone, and so is the governor's power to issue another one.
For more than 8 months, the legislature doesn't meet. And to be clear, this is normally how things go in even years in Wisconsin. But this is not a typical year.
In the fall, Wisconsin is the nation's COVID hotspot. Hospitals are overwhelmed. At least one sets up overflow beds in its parking garage. There's a day in November when more than 100 people die.
Nobody wants to see this happen, but Republicans and Democrats have dramatically different views on how to address it. Democrats want to restrict crowds and require masks. Republicans don't.
When you control the legislature, you get to make these calls. It's not always doing something new. Sometimes it's about doing nothing at all. One thing Wisconsin governors definitely have the power to do is introduce a state budget. And this is significant. The budget is the biggest bill lawmakers have to pass most sessions. And in Wisconsin, this power starts and ends with the governor.
For Tony Evers in 2019, this means a chance to make good on what he promised voters when they elected him. He introduces his budget in the ornate assembly chamber.
For Evers, it's a moment of optimism. He has a lot of ideas he wants to see happen. Here's where he lays them out.
Folks, let's get to the work. Thank you so much, and on Wisconsin.
This is where Tony Evers hands off his budget to the legislature. They have to pass it before it goes back to his desk to become law.
This gives them the chance to make some changes, to add or remove stuff. In the past, they might debate these items one by one.
But that's not how this legislature operates in 2019. When the budget comes up in committee, Republicans make a lot of changes all at once. The legislature's nonpartisan budget office reads through the cuts.
So what the motion does is it would remove from further budget consideration 131 items.
In case you didn't catch that, this will remove 131 items from the governor's budget in one fell swoop. The budget office reads through them one by one.
That transfer would be eliminated.
Would delete all of the provisions in the bill that would repeal the
accreditation of private schools. Those three all would be deleted from the bill.
This goes on for 22 minutes.
Lawmakers debate the cuts for a couple hours. Then Republicans pass them. And with one vote, the budget suddenly looks a lot different than the one the governor gave them.
This repeats itself when Tony Evers introduces his next budget, only he puts more in this one. And Republicans, like new Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, are annoyed with the governor.
You know, I sort of feel like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. I don't think the governor has learned his lesson at all. He's introduced exactly
Republicans remove 384 items from the governor's budget with a single vote. It's important to note that sometimes ideas don't become law because they're just not popular. So in Wisconsin, you'd never see lawmakers trying to ban beer or cheese because no one would want that.
But sometimes popular ideas, stuff people do want, don't go anywhere either. Why that is can be a little more complicated.
One person who has a really good handle on what's popular and what's not in Wisconsin is Charles Franklin. He's run the Marquette University Law School poll since 2012.
We have done 66 statewide polls in that time and have asked a bit over 1,200 different questions.
In Wisconsin, the quintessential purple state, a lot of these polls come back pretty close to 50-50. Republicans and Democrats know where they stand, and they're not budging.
Some issues do break through that divide. Sometimes this happens because societal views shift. Like gay marriage, for example. For years, the American public was against it, and then public opinion changed.
And there are signs that a similar change is happening right now with another issue.
I would say the marijuana issue is one in national polling that we've seen substantial evolution from majority opposition to substantial majority support over recent years, let's call it the last 15 years or so.
Lawmakers in other states have taken notice. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 18 states now allow recreational marijuana. They include Wisconsin's neighbors, Illinois and Michigan.
In Wisconsin, about 59% of voters supported legal marijuana in an April 2019 poll.
But when you add medical marijuana to it, then you start to get these true supermajorities of 80% or more in favor.
83% supported medical marijuana in that same poll. That included strong majorities of voters from both parties.
Franklin says there are only a few issues that poll as high as medical marijuana. For example, 80% of Wisconsin voters support background checks for private gun sales, with majorities across the partisan divide. One of the other issues that polls really high?
Solid majorities favored a nonpartisan redistricting commission.
That's right. Marquette polled on redistricting, and specifically whether people would like to take redistricting out of the legislature's hands, to have a nonpartisan commission draw the maps.
And 70% of Wisconsin voters wanted this, including majorities of Republican voters, Democratic voters, and independent voters.
But this is an issue where the details definitely matter, because to make this happen, the legislature would have to give up its own power to do redistricting. Franklin says that's not likely to happen.
So this is a case where the self-interest of the legislature flies in the face of whatever public opinion might be. And it's just incredibly rare in the country to have found a legislature willing to divest itself of that power.
That's not to say that people don't try. There is a long-shot effort in Wisconsin to switch to a nonpartisan redistricting commission.
And the governor set up his own commission to draw what he calls the people's maps.
There are also redistricting lawsuits pending in state and federal court.
But the legislature has made clear it has no intention to give up this power. It plans to draw the maps.
Remember, redistricting is happening right now. How it could all play out on the next episode of Mapped Out. Mapped Out is reported by Sean Johnson
and Bridget Bowden. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson and digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
You can also hear a new episode of Mapped Out next Wednesday here on Central Time and on Thursdays at 7 on The Morning Show. We'll continue to follow the latest in the redistricting process here on the Ideas Network and in the WPR News Department. You can find our recent coverage on the issue and stream live programming at WPR.org and on the WPR smartphone app. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, falling down can be a big health risk for seniors, and past data has shown it can be a big problem, especially here in Wisconsin. There's good news. There's a lot we can do to prevent those falls. Find out how, get advice maybe relevant to you or your family tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Being on the radio here, I think a lot about how to pronounce words, and sometimes I find out that words aren't really what I thought they were. Regular listeners may remember a brief spell a few years back where I tried to change the way I said a key word in redistricting. We say it gerrymandering, but the guy it was named after, Elbridge Gerry. I tried to promote gerrymandering, the pronunciation, not the practice, for a few weeks. I gave up because it was just too weird. Well, I just ran across another one. Have you heard the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? It's a horror classic, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. It became a metaphor for anyone who changed their behavior in different situations, Jekyll and Hyde. But I saw stuff going on online that looks legit. It says it may not be Jekyll. Stevenson was Scottish. There is a family name spelled like Jekyll, but pronounced Jekyll. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Am I going to make a thing about this on the air? Probably doesn't matter. Jekyll and Hyde comes up way less than gerrymandering. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a representative of the Wisconsin Hospital Association joins the show to tell us why the organization supports a new bill that would ban white bagging, a practice where insurance companies only cover medications, often at hospitals, only if patients use specific pharmacies. Now, Veterans Day is around the corner, and the Wisconsin Veterans Museum is exploring how veterans remember their time serving. Their new exhibit opening next week is called Souvenirs of Service. It showcases the things that Wisconsin vets and their families kept from their time serving as far back as the Civil War and as recent as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Kevin Hampton is the curator of history at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Really interesting sounding exhibit. Can you talk about the idea of using these souvenirs as a window into the stories behind them?
Certainly. I mean, I think souvenirs are a very relatable item. You know, we all have walked past a gift shop somewhere, whether it's in an airport or at the Dells, and we've all seen those, you know, magnets or the postcards. And it's this human impulse across time that we want to document the places that we've been, the people that we've known, the events in our lives that have some of the most meaningful components to our life story. So it is a natural way for humans to document their own stories, and it's no different for service members. And looking at their stories through what they choose to collect is very important.
And some of the objects you have are way more unique than any postcard I've ever sent, Kevin. I want to examine a couple of them, starting with a nylon dress. This is an incredible story. Can you share this one?
Sure, certainly. So the nylon dress is actually made out of what, you know, we would call parachute silk. Many people would see it. It's going to be a nice, beautiful white dress when you walk into the exhibit. And you might think it's a wedding dress, but it's actually, it's not. It's an evening gown. And the unique story for this one is actually that it comes from Lieutenant Floyd Steiner. In November of 1944, he's flying in a B-29 with the 40th Bomb Group. And as they're approaching their target city over Japan, they actually are, the plane is hit several times, but they managed to keep the B-29 airborne long enough to cross the China Sea and bail out over Japanese-occupied territory in eastern China. And after being rescued by local farmers and smuggled back to safety, he actually mails that life-saving parachute that he jumped from the B-29 with back to his wife in Eau Claire and requests that she use the material to make a dress for herself. And it's fascinating because if you look at how a parachute is constructed, you'll notice that there's, of course, there's a lot of parachute ropes and lines that are also used in the construction of this dress. And she actually carefully took apart each seam of fabric and reused it for her own gown design, and then actually got an experienced dressmaker as well as a rug maker to teach her how to braid the shoulder straps out of the parachute cord. And so she had this evening dress completed in 1945 and took a portrait of her wearing it and mailed it off to her husband, who was still serving in India at the time.
I got to ask, Kevin, how do you find stories like this and get people to come forward and share these artifacts with you?
It's really an opportunity for us to talk to the families. And we always, whenever I talk to the families, I always say, we want to get to know the person. We want to get to know your loved one, or in this, if it's a veteran themselves, we want to get to know you and tell us about you. A lot of people think of us as, you know, a military history museum, so you want the dress uniforms and you want the typical ephemera of war, but really we want to capture the person. We want to find those unique stories that make it personal. So it's really an opportunity for us to talk to the families about what's your favorite memory? What's your favorite experience? What can you tell us about these individuals if they've passed or if they're not there? Or if it's the veteran themselves, it's even better because we get the story firsthand.
I want to check out another artifact at your exhibit opening next week at the Veterans Museum, a Civil War era cannonball that somebody decided to cart back home to Wisconsin with them?
Yes, this is one of the little more morbid, if you will, souvenirs. This is actually the artillery shell that killed the second person from Wisconsin in the Civil War in July of 1861. So the company is the La Crosse Light Guard out of La Crosse. And they're under fire for the first time at the Battle of the skirmish at Blackburn's Ford before the first Battle of Bull Run. And as they're under artillery fire, the shell comes passing through their lines and kills Myron Gardner of La Crosse. And he actually he dies a few hours later. But the men of the company, about 20 minutes after this projectile lands in their lines, decide that they really want to bring this piece home. So they actually send someone back 20 yards behind them and picks this shell up off the ground and brings it back to the front lines. And they even write a few weeks later, they write home saying that it was examined by many of us and finally laid upon the ground, for we expected to move forward in a short time and it would be impossible to carry it. When they did start back towards camp, they then go on to list who picked up the ball and who carried it this, you know, a little bit away before they gave it to the next person, before they gave it to the next one, because it's heavy. But it's a great story because in the end, it's this, you know, monumental piece of history. You know, I was there at the first battle, if you will, and they really want to send it home so that it can be displayed in the front window of the newspaper in La Crosse. But one of the La Crosse, or one of the Milwaukee newspaper men, Rufus King, Charles King's father, he actually intercepts it and says, no, we're going to send this to Madison because it needs to be part of the state archive, but he sends it, of course, to his own newspaper headquarters in Milwaukee for display first. But eventually, long story short, it ends up with Myron Gardner's sister, who finally donates it to the state in 1888. But it is a little bit more one of the more morbid pieces.
And one of the stranger ones, so I want to check out one more. This is from a more recent war, a lighter with an image of Osama bin Laden on it.
Yes, this one was collected by Nora Prohaska. It was actually purchased from her, if you could say it was purchased in Iraq during her tour in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. So really, you know, you're in Baghdad in the spring of 2003 is when she arrives there, and her tour gets extended twice. And so one of the ways that they were able to bring a little bit of normalcy to their life was that they'd have essentially a flea market that they could go visit nearby in the green zone in Baghdad, and you could pick up things like DVDs and things like that for entertainment. But there was also an opportunity to pick up souvenirs. And she picked up a leather fan that had the image of Saddam Hussein on it, and a few other items, as well as this very interesting piece, this lighter, like you said, that has Osama bin Laden on it and the Twin Towers. And the story that she has from her oral history really exemplifies how she got it. You know, it wasn't because, obviously, this is a really important moment in American history, but the person who came to the, essentially to the outside the wire at their base just to sell it was there just to sell anything and everything they could. So they actually, the individual walks up to the wire and says, you know, here to sell, lighter, trade, barter. And this her sergeant, who's looking at this, says, do you understand what this even is, what this means? And she says, you know, watching all this, it's this almost just awestruck. Why would you try and sell this to us? This is, you don't know how offensive this even is. But it is that idea that, well, Americans will take, you know, buy whatever they want, whatever they can. So it is something that the sergeant then tells her, or tells the seller, you know, don't ever come back here. You can't sell this to us. But he never doesn't give the lighter back. She holds on to it, and keeps it with her. And she actually donates it here to the museum.
Now, Kevin, the exhibit is ready to rock next week. Are you still looking to hear stories from people, current service members, or people with maybe a family story to share?
We certainly are. We're very much still actively collecting. We'd love to have and share stories and photos of all Wisconsin veterans. It's one of my personal goals to have a photograph of every single Wisconsin veteran out there, because I think it's the faces behind the facts or the humanity behind the history that matters. So please consider sharing your story with us.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kevin Hampton, curator of history at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He was with us today to talk about their new exhibit, Souvenirs of Service. It opens next Friday, November 5th. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about building community through architecture.
Arijit Sen is an architecture professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's lived all over the world, from Mumbai, India to Muncie, Indiana. Now, he directs a field school at UWM's Buildings, Landscape, and Cultures program, where he's creating a new model for how universities can work closely with community partners. A podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered talked to Arijit. Here's the show's host, Jimmy Gutierrez.
Almost every architecture program has a field school. It's where students travel around Europe or study famous buildings. But in Arijit's version, students stay in Milwaukee and build something else, community.
The connection to community is a personal search. I went away from where I grew up, and I didn't have a place which I called home. I had people who I called home. What I realized over time is people, places, activities, memories is place, not just the physicality of it.
For the last 6 years or so, Arijit spent a regular presence in Washington Park, as well as Sherman Park, Thurston Woods, and other Northside neighborhoods. Through the field school, he has built up a network of residents and students actively working together.
I can come out here and I can start putting flowers out and watering my grass and cutting my grass, and then it's a ripple effect.
Sherry Fuqua has owned her home in the neighborhood for almost 2 decades now. Across the street from Sherry's house are 4 vacant lots in a row, a pretty big piece of land. After years of work, Sherry, with help from the city, transformed it into a park. She wants this park to connect Metcalf and Sherman Park, so she ended up calling it Unity Orchard.
It's just ideal, because you'll just see people just come over there and sit, just talk, or have lunch, or the kids over there playing. And other than that, it would just be just vacant paper, bottles, just, you know. But then it's a space like this that you actually, they'll respect the place. And as they see we building on it, just like that mural, you know.
Arijit students have done 2 projects now with Sherry to help develop Unity Orchard even more. First, they made a bunch of planters that doubled as benches. They also built a shed, or maybe it's a trellis, maybe it's a pergola. The idea was that it could collect rainwater for the plants and trees and provide a little shelter. But then the project ran into reality.
This time we had fundraised, we had $1,000, we bought materials for that. They did incredible amount of work. They even put the foundation, and then someone got killed in the neighborhood. And out of respect, we didn't really work on that. So we were hoping that it would be taken over by another person, but then pandemic started. So it sat there, and I was like, okay, it's gone. Well, 2 months ago, three of the students came back. They had graduated, they'd gone. They said, can you give me Sherry's number? And that's all they said.
It was sitting in their office over a year, and he actually just called me out of the blue, like, Miss Sherry, how y'all doing over there? Do you think we could come and put the brain catcher up? And I'm like, really, like, I know we don't have to, and I know school is out and we're not doing anything, but me and my guys would love to come and do that for you. You know what I'm saying? I almost cried, real talk. So I'm like, really, because see, it wasn't just his class and his credits that he was looking for. This is beyond. And they've came over here and actually forged relationship with guys. They know the guys. And actually, the guys come out and they help them put it up. And they, it's the realness that you look for. And you, a genuine connection, you'll know it. You'll know.
How we value places in our community is all about perspective. A Regent and the Field School tapped into that and ended up building something tangible. It's not just a new model for architecture programs, but it's also a new model for anyone who wants to make places better.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we take a look at a proposed state law that would ban white bagging, a practice where insurance companies require hospital patients to get their medications from certain special pharmacies. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the pandemic put the brakes on many young people moving into adulthood. Milestones were missed, opportunities to socialize and celebrate shut down. But a lot of teens have refused to press pause and use this time to pave a new path. You'll hear their stories about moving into adulthood in their own words. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a new bill from the state legislature seeks to ban an insurance company practice known as white bagging. White bagging is when an insurance company dictates specific pharmacies that patients must go to in order to get certain medications, especially those used in ongoing hospital treatments. The practice often affects patients with complex health problems like cancer. The proposed bill called Corrine's Law argues that this practice prevents patients from getting life-saving medication. Sometimes hospitals don't allow patients to get their drugs from outside pharmacies that their insurance companies are pointing them to, forcing patients to choose between paying out-of-pocket for hospital-approved drugs or finding care elsewhere. Joanne Ellig is the Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the Wisconsin Hospital Association, which supports that bill. Joanne, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, this is, I think, under the radar for a lot of people, for me included. Can you spell out a little more an example of how this white bagging practice would work for a patient?
Yeah, sure. So first, I think, you know, your introduction was great. And we are talking about medications for patients who have, say, cancer or rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis. So let's say you're one of those patients and you have to go into your doctor's office or your clinic or to a cancer center to get an infusion. Right now, I think patients don't really think about where do those medications come from. And typically, they're coming right from the provider's office, right from your hospital, the hospital's pharmacy. And what this practice does is it would say, okay, well, your provider can't use their own supply anymore from their pharmacy. They have to use the one that the insurer designates. And why should patients care? Well, it can cause delays. They might have to reschedule their treatment. And so it's really suddenly patients are having to know, where does my medication come from? And in Corrine's case, and Corrine is who the legislation is named after, mm-hmm. her hospital has said, we can't accept white bag medications. And so she was faced with either paying out of pocket or having to find a whole new care treatment team. So in the middle of her cancer treatment.
Why would a hospital say we won't take these medications from a legally licensed pharmacy?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think that one is some of the stories that we hear about in terms of the drugs not being delivered on time. They get damaged in shipping, hospitals being sent the wrong dose. And really, the hospitals feel like they can't control and they don't have the ability to really track and trace. They don't know where that medication has been through the entire process. We have stories of mail carriers dropping off shipments at a counter or at a wrong address, and you can't be sure that the medication has been kept at the right temperature, at the right humidity, at the right light. These are sort of special medications that need particular kind of care and handling. And so they're very concerned about the safety with these medications.
Now, a group of insurers and pharmacies who are opposing Corrine's law put out a press release saying, hey, this could be a cost saver. And I'm going to quote here. They say white bagging can protect patients from a hospital's markup for prescribed drugs, which on average runs between 200 to 400%, they say, of the hospital's acquisition cost. So maybe there's some inconveniences there, but it could be a big money saver ultimately. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, actually, our patient advocates have reported that patients actually can end up paying more in co-payments. If the hospital doesn't accept the white bag medication, the patient can pay full out-of-network cost and out-of-their-pocket for this. And really, I think if excessive reimbursements is the problem that they want to address, they can do that through negotiation, through their contracts with providers. But these policies are being implemented outside of the contract. They really interrupt that provider and patient care treatment plan. And so there are ways to address that, but this practice really isn't the way.
And this, some of the big providers say this isn't new, but it really seemed to kick into high gear just in the last couple of years with major insurance providers making this shift, whether it's a brand new policy or amping up an old one, right? This is something that's happening more and more often?
Right. Yeah. And it's a little surprising, actually, given everything that hospitals are facing during COVID and just really trying to make sure that they're continuing to provide that high quality care to patients. And we have found, yeah, that a few insurance companies announced their policy changes this year. And so that really did raise the visibility of the practice. And so that's, I think, why we're kind of starting to engage in this.
So we're going to call her. Therese is with us in Green Bay. Therese, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I know this has been briefly discussed in the beginning. I worked for a national health insurer for 34 years. This practice has actually been going on a while. And the reason insurance companies want to get involved in this is there's significant markup when these specialty drugs come from the doctor's office or directly from the hospital. There's a big profit being made off of the way the supply chain used to work. And insurance companies, believe it or not, have a bad reputation, but they're trying to save patients money. And specialty pharmacy, a lot of national insurers and even local have put in programs to make sure the things that your guest is saying about temperature and right conditions and delivery all work well. So this is not new, this system, and it has not had a lot of problems. Of course,
got to Teresa. We're just about out of time. Joanne, are healthcare providers just protecting a revenue source here?
No, I would say again, if they think that reimbursement's the problem, then we should do that, take care of that through negotiation. I would say that the study that you referenced really kind of cherry picks the drugs, and the way that contracting has changed over the last several years really has sort of addressed many of those concerns. Ultimately, we believe that patients just shouldn't be put in the middle And so I also, before we run out of time, would love to put a plug in for patientsfirstwisconsin.com. That's where you can find more information.
Joanne, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joanne Alleg is Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the Wisconsin Hospital Association. She joined us to discuss her organization's support of a law that would ban the practice we've been talking about called white bagging. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of people provide care to family members with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. The author of a new book shares lots of advice and resources and comfort for caregivers. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then congressional Democrats say they're close to nailing down a framework package to address climate change, child care, and much more. We'll take a closer look and talk about the latest ideas on how to pay for those plans. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.